Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, CEO and founder of Collab With. Today, I have the pleasure to talk to Sai Holzinger, a strategy and innovation lead at EGI Foundation. We are talking with Sai Holzinger about what is EOSC DIH, what is the DIH concept, so Digital Innovation Hub, what is the mission with the pilots of EOSC DIH, and how to apply to these projects, programs, and pilots. Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Sai Holzinger.
Welcome, Sai Holzinger, to the podcast Business of Collaboration.
Hi, thanks very much for inviting me.
So the first question is, what is EOSC DIH? What is this Digital Innovation Hub concept?
Yeah, so I think it's first kind of important to kind of understand what was the context or the background to why this specific digital innovation hub was set up. And it's specifically within side of the context of what is called the EOSC, or the European Open Science Cloud. And this is a major initiative from the European Commission to try to bring together a number of different infrastructures, and whether e-infrastructures who provide underlying computing, storage, data management, networking infrastructure for science, research, and academia, as well as research communities who have been spending years building services, value-added services for individual scientific domains on top of it, and start to bring them together in a little bit more of a coordinated, centralized fashion to kind of reduce a little bit of fragmentation from the research and academic space, and make it a little bit easier for science and researchers to find the services that are available, access the services that are available. So part of the, let's say, the mandate, initiative, or value of these kind of large public funded activities is kind of anything that's taxpayer funded can also be seen as a public good. So we want to make sure that, like, part of this infrastructure is also made available to commercial organizations, startups, SMEs, and industry. So one of the mechanisms that has been, let's say, increasing in commonality across Europe is this concept of digital innovation hubs, which is literally just a nice little name to put on when industry, private sector works together with the academic and research community to try to do some type of joint innovation projects. So I'm always in favor of avoiding reinventing the wheel when possible. So I thought that the Digital Innovation Hub was, let's say, a natural mechanism to try to formalize how could the commercial sector work with the wider European Open Science Cloud initiative in order to take advantage of the technical services and the human expertise that exists across the community. So we set up this EOSC DIH, the European Open Science Cloud Digital Innovation Hub, and where the main goal is to have this be the mechanism by which industry engages with the European Open Science Cloud.
So yeah, that's super interesting. And as well, I would like to ask you about these services. Which kind of services you can find inside EOSC, for instance?
Yeah, so we really started, so this initiative kicked off in January of 2018, and I think that was really the kind of still the early stages of what the European Open Science Cloud was and how it was being defined and how did the community really want to involve it. So we started very simple with the, let's say, the the available e-infrastructure services, so the technical infrastructure as a service, so compute, storage, data management. But via the partnerships, we were able to offer different kinds of compute, so cloud, high throughput computing, high performance computing, HPC machines as well. And then with our partners, for example, with EUDAT, so data management services as well. So that was very technical at the beginning. And we had 6 business pilots that we kind of onboarded at the start of the EOS Cub project, just to basically have something in which we could get started with immediately. So then as we were kind of working in parallel, both supporting these initial business pilots with these kind of very technical services and also building up and maturing the Digital Innovation Hub itself, we then started to kind of expand out, right? So how could we facilitate more services that were available across the EOSC? So then we started, we ran an open call, I think it was sometime last year, and that was one of our main mechanisms to try to broaden out. And here it was quite interesting because people really started taking advantage more of the human expertise services. So they were really asking for support, for an example, in authentication and authorization, and how does that happen in a distributed environment, and things like in big data analytics, and security related aspects. So there was all kinds of different human services that they were also looking to take advantage of. So really helping them to implement and build up a product or a service that they had in mind, and how this could be implemented in a more distributed environment. So I think that was probably the most interesting activities. It was a challenge trying to, because it forces you to deal with many more pieces of a puzzle in order to pull them together. But I think in the end, it provided the expertise that we kind of needed for how do we want to almost be like a filter mechanism for what are hundreds of services that are now available in the EOSC portal. Yeah. And how do we help people make sense of what's available in that catalog so that it can then be scaled down or tailored to exactly what they need. I think the other services, so we are, let's say, you can say that we're kind of limited in these kind of technical and human services that we're offering from the partners who are actually in the Digital Innovation Hub and running and coordinating it with. So one of our mechanisms for trying to extend the service portfolio itself is through strategic partnerships. Because let's be honest, we won't be able to implement, run, and coordinate every single service that exists across it. So I can give you one example with the Deep Hybrid Cloud project, which was set up to, they basically implemented or designed some machine learning services. So we established a strategic partnership with Deep so that when one of our business pilots needed machine learning, we were able to then offer that service through our strategic partnership. So we do infrastructure services. We're now onboarding a little bit more through our partners' data itself, because I think access to data is going to be the extending opportunity for the European Open Science Cloud. We try to offer the human services, technical support required to do that. And then I think the other service that we offer through the Digital Innovation Hub is what we call marketing and visibility. And this is, I think, a very underappreciated service from the wider community, because if you think of a startup or an SME, they're in their small local market and they're trying to, say, build out, get new clients and new partners and maybe even access some funding. But it's very difficult when you have very limited resources that are fully dedicated to the development of the actual product that they're trying to bring to market. So sometimes partnering with a European-wide organization provides them access to a broader set of contacts in which they can develop their own collaborations. They can get visibility of what they're doing so that then they can get recognition or maybe even start to participate in future EC-funded projects, which is another world in and of itself. And working with startups and SMEs, it's very clear that it is not fully understood what is available, how to get involved, and how the whole public funding mechanism space. So we've tried to provide them with the available opportunities outside of the EOSC Digital Innovation Hub as well, just in terms of a knowledge exchange from that point of view. And this is very highly appreciated from the SMEs that work with us.
So, and what is your mission with the pilots of the EOSC DIH?
So without sounding, let's say, overly benevolent, our main mission is really just to help them to implement or to grow, to design new products or services. You would be surprised if you see the statistics on how low the percentage of digitization within side of startups and SMEs actually are. So really what we want to try to do is bridge it. We're not trying to do everything. We don't have every single service that ever existed. But however, if we see that there are some services that are available through the European Open Science Cloud and our partners, and there is a way that we can help grow a small company to becoming a larger company, which means new jobs, new revenue, then we want to do that. There are a number of digital innovation hubs that are actually highly specialized. They're in almost every single sector. You can find that there is a specialized digital innovation hub, whether it's in like manufacturing, Internet of Things, whatever that is, big data, artificial intelligence and stuff. So where we're kind of operating is almost in an agnostic space, where we have the underlying services that we can offer to almost any one of those specialty digital innovation hubs. And then we allow the sector experts to basically build on top of what they're doing, access the data so that they can build something, provide them with the underlying infrastructure so that they can build something. So in, I think this is probably what is a challenge and interest from what we're doing in the EOSC Digital Innovation Hub is the broad range of pilots that have been that we have been working with. I mean, they range from finance to environment to space to agriculture to trucking. I mean, we pretty much run the gamut with the types of pilots that we've been supporting. So we've started with six, I mentioned before. So in parallel to setting up the Digital Innovation Hub itself, after the 3 years of the project, we ended up supporting a total of 18 business pilots, which is almost 30 individual SMEs that we've provided support to. So.
That's very good. And who can apply to these projects, programs, and pilots?
Well, we're pretty much open to anyone. I think the main thing is whether or not we can demonstrate the value that by accessing the services, they can they would want to do X and Y. So, I mean, I have probably three times as many conversations with individual companies than what we end up being able to run a partnership or a pilot, and that's okay. But really, that's what we're looking for. We normally have, let's say, an initial discussion with anyone who's interested in accessing it, and we really try to dig into the details to say, what is it that your company does? What is it that you're trying to do? And we really try to do this matching, this filtering, because it's very difficult for them to just kind of go to the EOSC portal and scan and say, oh, I want to do X. They want to come to a contact point, and then we do the kind of mental mapping between what they want to do, what problems they're trying to solve, and then we can kind of select from the menu of services that are available through the European Open Science Cloud, and we try to match those together. If there is a match, this is great, then we move forward. If not, friends as before, and then we move on. So
but
we're really trying to open.
Yeah, I think you are mentioning now a very important point. Like, sometimes we have to digitalize like the data, no? Like, for you, it's very easy to access the EOS marketplace of the services. But at the same time, you need a human being like you to assess and to help the company to understand their needs. And then sometimes we can do this with an AI machine algorithm, you know, to matchmaking. But sometimes we can not lose the human being touch. You know, our brains are very powerful as well, and we have to make this kind of complement. How do you see this?
I think that's the word that you use, is that they're complementary,
yeah.
Right? It's always going to be this mix between humans and machines, right? I mean, the digital or automation and things like that can really help our lives. It makes us a bit more efficient, it makes things a bit more effective and things like that, but I don't find them to be like a pure replacement for everything. Mm-hmm. So especially whenever you're in an unsure environment and you're just not sure if this is in fact the right thing, you just want to talk to somebody. Maybe you found it and maybe you submitted it and things like that, but is it really truly what you want? And sometimes it's nice just to talk to a human. You get that little bit of confirmation that you needed, and then you can move forward from a technological space. I mean, this is quite aligned to a phrase that I used to use, sometimes I still do, is if a credit card can solve your problem, we're probably not for you, because that's not really in the space that we're working on. We have a very high human element to what we're providing. Basically, companies are coming to us because a credit card is not solving their problem. They have a bigger need that they really need that kind of human or expertise support. And then that's where we come in, and that's the kind of the value that we provide on top of what is a, let's say, sometimes could even be viewed as a commodity service. So. Mm.
So as we did a pilot with CollabWeb as well, and we integrated the SSCO, so the single sign-on, and checking like the academics from and researchers from universities in Europe, they can access the CollabWeb platform with their emails and passwords from universities. And as well, we did the first integration of the CollabWeb marketplace with the EOSC marketplace. What do you think and like about this pilot?
I think, well, this is a perfect segue and a perfect example to what we were just talking about, this blend between technical and human, right? Mm-hmm. Because so CollabWeb provides us with the ability to access expertise that we may need across a spectrum of knowledge and expertise and sectors as well, but has been facilitated through the integration of a technical solution, right? And we're trying to facilitate the access to human expertise via technical integration. And because if you don't solve, let's say, the headaches that users find when they're clicking between stuff. And one of them that we found is this kind of authentication, forcing people to sign up 600 times for six different things is basically one of the biggest barriers that we find when moving between different service providers, different contexts and stuff. And AAI is like one of these facilitation mechanisms to just try to make it easier for people so that when they click from one thing to the next, they don't find themselves having to re-sign up, and that's another username, another password, and they're just like, you know what, I'm not doing that, and then they'll go back and they'll just resort to some well, I'll just send an email to this person because I can't figure out how to do that. So I think Collab With was quite interesting because it bridged those two things. It was, we needed additional access to experts who could help us solve what are very diverse set of problems. If you, especially in the startup and SME space, it's amazing how different they are. They're all trying to carve out their own niche market with their own specific product or service. So they all have different challenges, and no one individual digital innovation hub will be able to solve this. So you have to have a very robust partner network in order to satisfy the needs and demand from SMEs, which can be very, have a high level of overhead if you try to do that yourself. So I think Collab With provides us with the access to the human side of it, but then, yeah, like I said, it needed to be facilitated with a technical solution, or it wouldn't have worked as well. So I think this has been a very unique pilot from that perspective.
As well, you are working at EGI, and you are American. How did you get there? What is your story?
Yes, my truck from university into the military. So I had joined, after university, I had joined the U.S. Air Force, just because I didn't know what to do with myself. So after basic training, my first job, my first duty station was in Pisa, Italy. So I spent 2 years in Italy as an American military person. And then whenever I got out of the military, I had already been out of the house for 6 or 7 years. And the idea was, do I go back and live with mom and dad, or do I stay in Europe and hang out? So I had an Italian girlfriend at the time. And I stayed here, started teaching English as a second language, which was my first job in Italy. And then I have a business management and communications background. So I found a job as a project manager in a marketing and communications company here in Pisa, who were doing European Commission funded projects, et cetera. So that then turned into a professional job, and that turns into getting married and having kids, and 15 years later I'm still in Europe.
15 so, years.
Yeah, 15 years still here.
That's like an American dream, you know.
Almost. Yeah, I found the American dream in Italy, I guess. I was working in these EC funded projects. One of them was in those days it was called the EGEE project. And that was really what was setting up this distributed computing infrastructure. It was through a series of projects that was coordinated at CERN to read the data that was coming from the Large Hadron Collider. And after several years, the European Commission was like, well, this seems to be going well, but we need to find a more stable structure rather than doing this through project funding. So there was a 2-year design study to try to figure out, well, how can we have a sustainable model for continuing this kind of distributed computing infrastructure? And that's when EGI was born, basically in 2010. So I had already been working very closely with the buildup of what was the European grid infrastructure and the setup of the EGI Foundation. So I applied in one of the early rounds of it, and I started at EGI about 8 months or so after it had been established. I'm still one of the, so there's a few others that had started immediately that are still there, Tiziana and Sergio and Celine and Mary Louise, but I think I've been there now 10 years. I just hit my 10-year mark at EGI. I lived in Amsterdam for 3 years when we first set up it, and then family situations, I ended up moving back to Italy. So I work remotely for EGI for the last couple of years. But.
Mm-hmm. But what is EGI? What are the services you are bringing? And how companies and other organizations contact you for collaboration and for buying your services?
Yeah, I mean, EGI started as a pure infrastructure as a service, as a service, and this existed. I mean, there was the batch computing, grid computing, which was, and this is even predates cloud computing, really. So we were offering infrastructure services, storage services, data management services for research and academics. It really started with high energy physics, but then it branched out to other user communities or other research communities, other domains that found the infrastructure to be useful. So we moved into life sciences and earth sciences and chemistry and biology. I think, like, you name it, we are very similar to the EOS Digital Innovation Hub. We're very agnostic when it comes to the scientific disciplines that we offer. And then again, we started to then add human services on top of it. So training and service management and information security. And we have our own, we were talking about authentication and authorization service, because if you want to have a federated infrastructure that is seamlessly works across 30 countries and bridges more than 200 individual data centers, facilitating, I think right now we're up over 70,000 researchers that use the EGI infrastructure, you have to have these kind of common tools and services that allow different data centers across different countries to work together. So therefore you need monitoring and accounting and authorization services. So we provide these kind of common set of tools, again, to avoid individual countries having to reinvent the wheel.
That is one question for me many times. I don't know if it's right or not. Like, for instance, startups and all the SMEs and some companies, now they are moving all the computation on cloud into Amazon. Because they have this kind of free service, but then they have to always to pay. So EGI could be this kind of substitutive service and product from Amazon. Instead of sending all of our data to Amazon, we can channel to EGI.
So I wouldn't consider EGI, let's say, a direct competitor of Amazon. I think though we're offering similar services, they're in a different space with a different, let's say, a different business model. Like I said before, we're mainly involved in the pre-commercial side of the activities. There are some scenarios in which we could support commercial activities, but these have to be under very specific conditions that get met. So I would say that they're very complementary services. But like I said, if Amazon can solve your problems with a credit card, then most likely you're going to do that. But if you need some type of higher level services or support or integration and things like that, then we normally is where we kind of step in and help.
How can companies and other organizations contact you for collaborations or for buying your services?
We have two, I think there's two options right now in the moment. So our service catalog is available on the EGI website, but we also have the EGI marketplace. So we do have a marketplace in which you can basically find the service, define the service that you're looking for, even for some technical requirements. If you have some understanding of your computing requirements, for an example, you can put that into the marketplace and hit submit. And then that goes through our formal service management activities on the back end so that we can facilitate the requests. So one is a formal service request submission bit, and then the other one is, again, the human one. If you're just not sure and you just want to contact us, then we have our generic emails that are available. So if you are a regular research and academic, there's contact@info@EGI. But then if you are from a commercial organization and you go to our business pages, where there is the services we offer to commercial companies, and then there's business@EGI.eu, then you can just send an email and I'll process it from a human point of view. So there's two ways of two ways of accessing.
And like you are working with the Digital Innovation Hub. So my now the question is, what is innovation for you?
Yeah, for me, innovation is basically trying to create or improve on anything. So either you create something that doesn't exist or you're trying to improve upon something that exists. So it's that kind of state change. And so anytime you're trying to do a state change, you're innovating somehow or some way. There can be big innovations and there can be even small innovations. So if you want to do very minor but several improvements to your existing software, that's mm-hmm. how do you do that? How do you go about identifying even minor changes? How do you want to mm-hmm. how do you identify those minor changes that you want to make? How do you feed those through the pipeline? That's innovation as well. So I think there's different flavors of innovations and there's definitely different levels of innovation, but either way it needs to be managed with inside of an organization, because either two things happen. Your services become super stagnant because you're not improving upon what you're doing. Your business becomes obsolete because you're not evolving to the change to the changing market, or you are losing very good ideas because people have the ideas, but you don't have a mechanism by which you can capture those ideas and then make some management decisions about those ideas mm-hmm. and then feed those through the pipeline to your technical teams and then move that into a production environment. So for me, innovation is that full pipeline.
And then innovation, well, the question is, what is collaboration for innovation?
Yeah, I mean, I find collaboration to be one of the most important things, especially when you're in a scenario where you have limited resources and time. So that's definitely one trigger to concentrate on collaborations, because this is where you can get access to expertise or also additional service or innovation opportunities. The other one is just simply because not everybody knows everything. So you may be a big organization which is well resourced, but sometimes collaborations can also be an influx of new ideas and a new perspective, maybe, or even maybe your company culture is blocked into one single company culture, and bringing in somebody externally can just kind of shift the brain into thinking about a specific situation in which you weren't in a way that you weren't thinking about it before. So it doesn't always have to be an optimization of resources. It can also just be an influx of a different perspective or new ideas. So I think doing strategic collaborations is an extremely important activity for any organization, whether you're commercial or academic, or whether you're small or large.
Mm-hmm. And like you are part of the community of CollabWith as well, I know. So what is CollabWith for you?
So it's the network. It's the building up of those relationships. I mean, and I also think sometimes now, even more importantly, we used to do this pre-COVID. We used to do this and a lot of stuff in our conferences and meetings and things like that. Just the ability to meet people, right, and put a face to an email address and stuff like that. And then, because I can't tell you how invaluable it has been over the years, whenever somebody comes to me with a question or a problem, my brain goes directly to a person that I met or I know, and maybe I can put people together. So CollabWith provides that opportunity to basically give you access to different people, to different expertise, and being part of that then allows you to maneuver pieces a little bit easier, answer questions a little bit better. And I think without that, you then find yourself being stuck in, either you have to know everything or you can't help people. So if you really want to be in a coordination position where you're trying to bridge people together, then you need access to these people and expertise, and you need a way to find them. And I think that's what Collaborates provides, a structure to who is involved in what and who can I reach out to if I have a specific question or problem to solve.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
What is the thing you are most proud of?
The thing that I am most, that's a very interesting question. What is the thing that I'm most proud of? Well, maybe I could say that I've been married for 15 years and I have 3 kids, and so I'm quite proud of the fact of my marriage and my kids. But I think professionally speaking, I think actually EGI itself is a form of pride for me, because I was there at the beginning and I was there before it even existed. And people kind of tend to forget that it wasn't very clear if this thing could be sustained and how it would evolve into the future. And we worked very hard in those first couple years trying to constantly find that balance of value that we were delivering from the central coordination body to our federation members. And in fact, when the EGI was established, we didn't even have, I'd say, we knew what services we were offering, but it would all be dependent on who you talked to. Everybody kind of had their own variations or explanations of what EGI was. So I was one of the, I think, integral part of the team that first set up its service catalog, its understanding of its organizational structure, a little bit through the standard that we ended up developing, which is called FITSM, through the FEDSM project. Being involved in that project really helped kind of define what EGI was and put together the sustainable structures in it. And having hit my 10-year anniversary and thinking, wow, what we've done and what we've put together is quite impressive. And I am very proud, probably, to have been at since the beginning of EGI and seen what we have created over the years.
And the failure you were learning the most from?
Ooh, failures are a daily activity. The failures that I'm learning the most from. Yeah, so I think there's probably different levels. There's different levels of failures. I'm not sure that there's like a major catastrophic one that I could think of that ultimately shaped my worldview, let's say. But I'm in the space of kind of, I mean, even if you want to look at it from a service management point of view, the continual service improvement approach, I kind of take that to myself as well, is that feedback for me is very important. I like to know that I'm very invested in work, and I would like to make sure that like what I'm working on and what I'm investing on is the right thing. And if it's not the right thing, then I want to be able to quickly adapt and stuff. So I'm in a very short feedback loop that if I'm not doing something in the correct or proper way, I want to get feedback on that as early as possible. Obviously we had these yearly appraisal reviews with the line managers and stuff, and that gives you areas for opportunities for improvement. So for me, it's all based on honesty and open communication. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that I don't actually ever get to having a major failure, because that means that there was a breakdown much earlier than the point that I got to that failure. So try to keep the failures small, though often and can be difficult to somehow manage from your own personal pride point of view. But I think it's important to kind of identify small problems before they become big ones.
Yeah, you think the military experience helped you to become a good manager, or to manage this kind of before coming to a bigger crisis, you know?
Military experience is very interesting. Actually, it's very difficult. I would have to say that it probably shaped me a little bit more as an individual rather than as a manager, because I think it instilled a little bit in me in terms of like self-discipline, mm-hmm. and authority and how to kind of self-govern and things like that. I think it was very important from that, taking them from like a boy to a man kind of thing. As for a manager point of view, I'd actually have to say that I'm quite opposite of the military. In fact, I think sometimes military people can struggle in the civilian world because there is a do as I say, there is no other choice, and it is very top-down authoritarian. Whereas from a management point of view, I don't think that to be a very successful strategy for a good manager. I think managers need to manage people, manage personalities, and there should be no single approach to your management. You can operate on your own principles. So I'm a very principled person. I'm a very loyal person. And loyalty probably stems a little bit from my own background and playing sports or the military, or whatever have you. However, there is no one size fits all to management. And I think good managers are able to adapt depending on the actual situation that you're trying to manage. So whether or not you need to be strong, you need to be empathetic, you need to be forceful, or you need to listen. You need to be able to run the gamut from a good manager point of view. And also, we're all different. So you have to manage the personalities of the people, temperaments of people, skills and experience of people. So I think being a good manager is very difficult, but I don't think taking a militaristic approach to management is probably a good idea.
No, I am asking because Simon Sinek, you know, like he was writing the books about why and leadership. He has a very good friend coming from military, and he's taking always these military examples for leadership, you know, like, and it's very funny because as you mentioned, it's completely different approach, but maybe it's more for self-development and personal growth. Like he's taking this kind of, you know, examples from the military.
Yeah, I think one-line quotes and one-line things, I mean, they have their time and their place. I think sometimes being able to come up with a nice quote or something to encapsulate a given situation is always quite nice, I think. However, I don't think that should be one's guiding philosophy for how to deal with stuff. So I think we need to separate that there are good quotes and concepts and one-liners that can come from the military approach. But I think I'll leave it at simply being a one-liner that you can use randomly in the course of conversations or communications with individual people. So,
yeah. So now we are going more to the personal questions, and these ones are super quick and fast.
Sure.
What is your favorite place for holidays?
I typically like someplace warm, someplace where I grew up in the U.S., I was in the mountains, so it typically got quite cold and snowy, and our vacations were 1 week a year, and we always went to the beach. So I typically kind of kept that kept that in my system is basically go someplace really warm and just hang out.
Mm-hmm. How your mornings look like? Do you have a routine in the morning?
Yeah, I'm a night owl. I enjoy the night. I hate the mornings, so I am not a morning person. Typically, my wife deals with everyone and the kids in the morning, and I need a few coffees before interacting with people in the morning. But I do have a routine of when I get up and when I have coffee and when I get ready and when I start work. I think routines are quite important for stability in life, but my brain tends to get going later in the day, let's say, than very early in the morning.
What are you doing with your spare time on weekends?
Well, now that the weather's getting nice, I enjoy running. I go to run. I also have to work off the winter weight that I go over the course of that time. But typically, it's dealing with the kids. I work a lot, but then whenever I'm not working, I can just crash and do nothing. So watching TV, binging TV shows on Netflix. I can go down YouTube rabbit holes very quickly and spend hours on YouTube videos and stuff like that. So yeah, running, kids, and TV videos, movies, stuff like that.
And what is your favorite music?
Yeah, this has probably changed. This has probably changed over the years, and I'm sure what I thought was cool when I was younger, my kids no longer think is cool, and what they think is cool, I don't understand. But so I'm more of a 90s guy, so 90s music, so from the early grunge to 90s rap and hip-hop music is actually still what I listen to when I run. But nowadays, really, any kind of pop music that's on, any kind of music that runs nowadays. I think there was a period of time where I was really into the Dave Matthews Band, but yeah, so maybe this is showing my age more than anything.
Thank you very much, Sai, for this conversation. I think it's very useful to understand the whole European landscape for innovation and for research computing, we can say, and how to apply to the pilots for the EOS VIH.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting space. I mean, it's definitely not monotonous, that's for sure. There's, I think, a lot of opportunities, but I think that's what keeps the job interesting. So, yeah, and thanks to you for the invite. Sometimes you just don't get a chance to kind of have a chat with people. You're trying to condense everything into a 15-minute talk or presentation with PowerPoint slides and stuff like that. So for me, it's been quite interesting just to basically be able to sit down and have a chat with somebody. So thanks very much. I quite enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you, Sai.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabwave.org. See you next week.